The U.S. gets a huge win in Brazil. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week I'll talk with a reporter in Cleveland about a proposal to tie stadium funding to how well the teams perform.
And then we'll get an update on the Columbus Crew as the team is halfway through the season and looks to make a run at the playoffs.
But first, another soccer team stole the headlines this week. Ian Dark there on ESPN broadcasting the U.S.'s win over Ghana.
The Americans were finally able to beat Ghana after being ousted from the last two World Cups by the Black Stars.
And a great game, obviously. A big tipping point for American soccer?
I think so. They haven't fared well in their first game of World Cup group play, hardly ever. Back in 1930, they won their first game in group play. Then they won one other time in, I believe, 1980. But they've done terribly in group play, and it looks like they're poised to make it out of the group of death along with Germany.
That's assuming John Brooks has a dream about Portugal.
He has to have a dream about Portugal. It looks like the U.S. are going to need at least one more win or a draw and then get lucky to move on. But with the way Portugal's looking, with a couple of nagging injuries and then one of their best players out because of a red card against Germany, the U.S. is in prime position to advance out of group play.
The best news for the U.S.,
Cristiano Ronaldo. He left practice on Tuesday with a little bit of a knee injury, but I expect him to play it. I expect him to be 100%. He's the best player in the world, world's most valuable soccer player. He just doesn't have the team he needs to be able to dominate the way Portugal should be dominating. The good news for the United States is Pepe, one of the best players, not Cristiano Ronaldo type, but one of their scorers received a red card against Germany for headbutting Thomas Müller. And that red card puts you out for the next game in group play. The same goes if you get two yellow cards across two games. That third game, you have to sit out. So Pepe is not going to be able to play against the United States, and that's a game Portugal needs to really stay alive in group play.
But Germany looks like by far the best team out of that group so far.
They do. They've only played one game, but they made easy work of Portugal. They go deep every year in the World Cup. They've got three World Cup wins over their history, and they've appeared in six finals or something like that. I'd have to check those numbers, but they are the class of soccer, and they look great in the group of death.
Some other storylines going into the second week of the World Cup. England lost its first match. Mm-hmm. Also, the Netherlands was able to stay alive by beating Australia.
The Netherlands are now 2-0 in group play, and they're one of those teams that kind of people have as their dark horse. They made a deep run in the 2010 World Cup and really shocked a bunch of people that they're a team to get excited about, with Robin van Persie, which he received his second yellow card, kind of what I talked about earlier, so he won't be able to play that third game, but they've already clinched out of group play. They're in a group with Australia, Chile, and Spain, who's been kind of a shock so far in the World Cup.
They're out. They're not advancing past group.
They're done. They've lost their first two games. They got routed by the Netherlands. I think it ended up being 5-1. It was insane. The Netherlands poured on in the second half and looked like a scoring machine. And then they were shocked by Chile on Tuesday. They got beat by Chile. They could not score a goal. They lost 2-0 to Chile. So they're done. They don't have a point, and they have one game left, and probably the most worthless game of the World Cup so far is coming up. Will be Spain and Australia, where neither team has won a game, and it doesn't really matter.
Spain is defending champions. They won it all in 2010. Getting back to the U.S., does the U.S. advance to past group play?
There is a great chance they do. If you're going to make me make a prediction, I say they do. Percentages, according to index power rankings and how well the team's best. If they get a draw in either of the last two games, I'd say they advance. If they get a win, they automatically advance. But if they get a draw against Portugal, they have a real competitive edge in that they played Germany in Germany's final game. And I expect Germany to beat Ghana pretty easily. And then Germany will have those 6 points and already be clinched for that spot. And then they might be resting some of their players like Thomas Müller for that final game in the U.S., which would set the U.S. up nicely to grab a draw or a win from Germany, because Germany won't have any reason to play for it. With soccer at the forefront of many people's minds, we thought we'd get an update on the Columbus Crew.
The MLS team that's now 6 years removed from its only championship. Wow, that 6 years, mm-hmm. time flies, is in the playoff hunt again this year.
Yeah, they're currently on the outside looking in, but not by much. To recap the first few months of the season and to look at the remainder of it, we called Adam Jardy from the Columbus Dispatch.
Adam Jardy, welcome to After the Score.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So just to bring us up to speed, we're 15 games into the season, not quite halfway. The Crew are 4-5-6, 18 points. That puts them in a tie with New York for that final playoff spot in the East. As it stands, New York now holds that tiebreaker, and so they would get the final spot at this point. Still a lot of soccer left to play, though. Is this where you expected the Crew to be about at this point in the season?
Yeah, I think that their overall record is fairly reflective of the quality that they have. I think that if you were to sit here at the beginning of the season and say, you know, you're going to have some guys missing for World Cup duty, you're going to have some guys missing due to injury, you're putting in a new system, it's a new coach, a lot of new players, and we're going to give you this record when you go into the World Cup break, I think people would probably have said, yeah, that's about right. I think what skews it a little bit is the fact that they've been so I don't know if you want to say inconsistent or if you just want to say that they've been so extreme. They opened the year with a 3-game winning streak, the first time they've ever done that, and then they had an 8-game winless streak, which is the second longest in team history. And so I don't know that they're as good as that 3-game win streak. I don't think they're as bad as that 8-game winless streak. Overall, I think the record's probably right about where they should be.
Federico Higuain is known as the commodity on the team. He's the star. How's he playing so far this season? And can you talk about anyone else who's surprised or been really good or really bad for the Crew?
Well, I would say that Federico Higuain has made a very strong case to be a leading candidate for Player of the Year in Major League Soccer this season. When he has been on the field, he has been superb. His command is phenomenal. He's had some incredible goals. What he means to this team is so difficult to overstate, because when he's on the field, he's a difference maker. And in Major League Soccer, you need guys who can help you rise above the pack and can help you sort of dig out from the parity that you know, permeates the league. And he is a guy that can do it. He is phenomenal. He's been great to watch this year. On pace to probably have a career year as far as goals and possibly assists. The only downside is that he missed the last game and a half with a hamstring injury. Not believed to be serious. He should be back when they return to MLS play on the 28th against FC Dallas. But aside from that, it's been, you know, a perfect almost opening to the season for him. And then, I mean, if you go down the team, I mean, a young guy like Will Trapp, who actually unfortunately is also dealing with a knee injury, he's missed 3 games, but has been incredibly steady and has made a phenomenal impact now in his second season with the team. Is really kind of growing into a leadership role, into just a guy that you can count on, which for someone who grew up, you know, here in Central Ohio and just turned 21, I believe, in the offseason, he has a lot of leadership on his shoulders and a lot of on-field responsibility, and he's handled it really well. So, I mean, those would certainly be my 1A and 1B MVPs so far.
The Crew also have a new coach this year, Greg Berhalter. What's the beat on him? How does he seem to be doing?
Well, it's still a learning process for him in a lot of ways. And this is his second head coaching job. He coached over in Sweden and was fired for what the team owner described as a lack of offense. And so the Crew hasn't necessarily been as potent offensively as the fans would like. And so that's been a little concerning, I suppose. But you've got to look at the fact that he came in late October, early November, and has basically completely changed everything. I mean, they've restructured how the front office works. He's the head coach and the sporting director, so he's tasked with not only directing the on-field talent, but I mean, he's basically, at the end of the day, all the personnel decisions are his as well. I mean, he has people that advise him and help him, but he's really running the show. And so it's a lot to put on the shoulders of a guy who although he had played in Major League Soccer for a couple seasons a few years ago, had never coached in the league before. So there's a learning curve. There's a lot of crazy, strange roster rules when it comes to Major League Soccer. So he's really had to start from, I don't want to say square one, but not necessarily coming from a position of strength. And he's, by and large, he's done fairly well with it. I mean, there have been some questioning moves here and there. I mean, I thought that they completely misused Dominic Oduro when he was here until they traded him. They had a stretch where they played 3 games in 7 days, and he stuck with the same group, and they were clearly fatigued, and they were shut out in all 3 games. There have been situations that make you go, I don't know about that. But, you know, the team owner, Anthony Precourt, has put his faith in this guy, and, I mean, he's got a 3-year guaranteed contract. So, they're committed to letting him kind of grow, learn from his mistakes, and build what they think will be a sustainable winner.
Is that pretty common in MLS for coaches or other employees to have multiple responsibilities?
It really varies from team to team. Before Greg Berhalter was hired, the Crew had a head coach in Robert Varzija, they had a technical director in Brian Bliss, and then they had a team president / general manager in Mark McCullers. So basically between those three guys came all of the personnel decisions. And it was never 100% clear, okay, well, whose responsibility is this? Whose responsibility is this? And if this guy is being hired or being signed, you know, well, who found him, and then how do we fit him in the roster? It's all the duties of the decision makers were always a little bit muddled. But now with having basically just one guy making the decision, it makes things a lot easier. And it also makes it easier if things go right, you know who to give the credit to. And if they go wrong, you know who to blame. So it really varies widely from team to team in the league.
One of the veterans on the team, Michael Parkhurst, had kind of an outside chance at representing the red, white, and blue at the World Cup this year. Talk about what the Crew are doing during this World Cup break, because they're not just taking a break and relaxing. They're actually playing some games, yeah?
Yeah, well, they did take 5 or 6 days off. So heading into the break, they played, it was 3 games in 8 days, and they were pretty gassed by the end of that. So, I think they played on a Saturday, and then they were off until the following Saturday. And then they returned to training. They trained Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then Tuesday night they had a U.S. Open Cup game up in Akron where they played against the NASL Indy 11. And they had a game, and they're resuming training and getting ready to get back to MLS action, week and a half from now or so. But yeah, they're still keeping busy. They got a little bit of time off, which, it's a long season in Major League Soccer. When you play from March, early, beginning of March till the end of October, you get a chance somewhere in there to take 5 or 6 days off. You've got to appreciate that. And so they kind of got their heads straight a little bit. And you get off your legs a little bit, get over some of that fatigue. A couple of guys had some minor surgeries, and now you're just kind of healing and resting and getting ready to start the grind again here in 8 or 9 days.
We've been talking about the Columbus Crew, and we've been joined by Columbus Dispatch beat writer Adam Jardy. Adam, great to talk to you.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me. Hey, 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 Columbus!
Hey, 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 Columbus! Thomas, it looks like they have actually found the secret to make Cleveland teams win.
Pick up and move everything to Baltimore?
That too. But there's actually something a little more positive, a little outside the box. Tie stadium funding to how well the teams perform.
Oh, that sounds crazy.
It does sound crazy. It's out there. It's pretty wacky. But people are talking about it, and there is a serious proposal from Ed Fitzgerald, the Cuyahoga County executive, also a Democratic nominee for governor, to see if there really is anything to this. I called Nick Castell. He's a reporter at Cleveland Public Radio Station WCPN. So, Nick, a lot of people have called this proposal a gimmick from a guy running for governor. Is this so-called win tax proposal getting any real serious traction up there?
Well, right now it's a little hard to tell if there are many elected officials who are supporting the idea. The city of Cleveland has said that they support splitting the sin tax money that was raised in Cuyahoga County 3 ways evenly among the 3 teams, and they're kind of buckling down and standing by that now that Ed Fitzgerald has come forward with his proposal. There are also members of county council who have said that they're not so keen on the idea, so it's a little hard to tell right now if there are any public officials who are willing to stand up and say, yeah, let's give this idea a shot.
So lay this out for us. It basically ties a portion of public funding from this so-called sin tax that funds the team stadiums, it ties a portion of that funding to how well they perform, right?
Exactly. So the Syntax, as it stands right now, it was just renewed for 20 years. That money is supposed to go toward the three stadiums in Cleveland for upgrades, for new scoreboards, a new roof, other kinds of improvements that these aging stadiums, that the teams at these aging stadiums need. Now, what Ed Fitzgerald is proposing is that that money will still go toward all the stadiums for their improvements, but a small portion of it, about one-fifth of the overall amount of money given each year, would be held back, and that would be distributed to the teams based on how well they perform.
Is there any precedent for this?
I'm not sure of any precedent for this. I've talked with a couple national experts who watch these sports deals between the public and teams pretty closely, and they weren't aware of anyone ever really trying this or proposing this before. So it seems like sort of a new idea.
What are some of the concerns raised about it? I've heard some people talk that it might lead to kind of cyclical losing with teams playing poorly, then stadiums getting less funding, and free agents not wanting to come to town. Can you talk about maybe that and some other concerns about this?
Well, you can probably think of a lot of different ways. It may be easy to overthink this idea because right now there aren't a whole lot of details. One big question is, how is this even going to work? Right now, Ed Fitzgerald has not really proposed any mechanism for deciding which teams are playing better than others. I mean, how do you compare a basketball team to a football team to a baseball team? Do you look at winning percentage, playoff wins, making it to championships? None of these ideas are really fleshed out yet. Now, Fitzgerald says he wants all of those questions to be decided by a panel of sports fans that he would appoint who would sort of oversee this new program. Other questions are whether this is even allowable under the lease agreements that the public has signed with the three teams. You know, that money is supposed to go toward improvements to the stadiums. And there's some question as to whether Cleveland and Cuyahoga County can really tinker with that agreement very much at all.
Does Ed Fitzgerald know that every sports fan in Cleveland is basically on the verge of suicide and he doesn't want them deciding on funding? I mean, I'm kidding, but this idea does sound kind of absurd.
Well, and, you know, I think Fitzgerald acknowledged that maybe this plan is not going to, in its final form, look exactly like what he's proposing right now. But he kind of says that he wants to start a conversation. And to his credit, he has started a conversation. He's made appearances on numerous sports talk radio shows in Cleveland, not usually a place where you're discussing countywide policy or statewide politics, but they brought him on to talk about this idea. I've even produced a story for NPR nationally. So people are interested in this concept. Whether it has any legs and ends up finally being codified into law is maybe a different question.
I'm sure team owners are not very interested in this, though.
Well, it's hard to know what exactly they think. I did place calls to the teams when I was reporting on this story a couple weeks ago. I only heard back from the Indians, and all they said was, we're not going to have any comment on this.
Mm-hmm. Ed, have they considered maybe using this money to sign a quarterback or a point guard for the Cavs?
Well, I'm sure there's lots of things people would love for this money to go toward, maybe bringing LeBron back. But the honest truth is that this money was raised for improvements to the stadium, structural improvements and upgrades to the stadiums, and that's really all it can be used for.
Mm-hmm. Nick Castell is a reporter at WCPN in Cleveland. He's covered Ed Fitzgerald's so-called win tax proposal. Nick, thanks again.
Thank you.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can always find us at WOSU.org/AfterTheScore and on Twitter at After the Score.
You can also stream the show using the WOSU Public Media mobile app, and you can also download it on iTunes. Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley.